Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Jean Gallagher, and welcome to Discover Rising Tides, how the outside makes the inside better, where we explore the importance of the outdoors in maintaining life balance. And through this series, we'll be talking with women business owners to understand their journey. And today, as always, we start with our Healthy Living, Happy Life segment with Denise Stegall. Hey, Denise.
Hey, how are you, Jean?
I'm excited for today. There's some high energy happening here.
We got some energy. We're talking about success.
Yes. Denise is an international best-selling author of Healthy Living, Happy Life, a practical path to finding a healthy lifestyle that works for you, and curator of Healthy Living List. And this month's topic is Healthy Living, Happy Life from 3,000 feet, and how planning and organizing leads to a fulfilling life. And today, how success happens with the three P's.
Yay!
And then our second segment will be our main guest, Diane McClay. And I'm really excited for that too. And Diane and Denise are friends, and that's how we all connected. So we'll get to that. But let's start with you, Denise. Lynn, tell us about the three P's.
Okay, so we've been talking about planning from the 3,000 foot area. So kind of looking down from up there, like you're on a plane looking down, you know, you can see things much more clearly when you're looking from above. You know, we get stuck in our minutiae of every day. And so, you know, when we all want to be successful, right? And so we all read a lot of books, we listen to a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of gurus, follow podcasts, whatever it may be. But what happens is we kind of get a little bombarded by great information. Everybody has good information, great information. The challenge, I think, where we really start, we start listening to all of these gurus, you know, you and me and Diane included. but most of the challenge is before we start listening, we kind of need to know what success means to us. What is the path? Like how do we want to be successful? And of course, being successful means something different to you than it does to me. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to planning, we kind of have to go, okay, what is it that we actually want? In the big picture, that's what we're looking big picture, because then we can kind of we can get down to the nitty gritty a little bit more. So again, what is it that we want to succeed in? And you can do this, you know, overall, this is what I want in my life. This is what I want in my business. This is what I want for the next year. Mm-hmm. So it can be something that you work on the three P's. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. You can use the 3Bs, the 3P concept for all the different areas in your life. But I think what's important is we need to start with, again, core values. What are those things that are important to you? Why do you want this particular success? Why do you want to achieve these particular goals? And at that point, that's when we can say, okay, we need a plan. So the three P's, of course, we talked about this last time, are planning, prioritizing, and preparing. Now, what tends to happen when clients come to me, they've read all of these books and, you know, have all these bits and pieces of ideas. They've attended events, you name it. And so they've got bits and pieces of a plan. You know, a little bit from, you know, Dr. J and a little one, more information from this particular book. And so they have this compilation of ideas and it's overwhelming because they liked this piece of one program, another part of a different one. And so they kind of look at all of this going, okay, this is my overarching goal or plan that I want to succeed in, but I'm going to try to do different. I'm going to try to plan in three different ways, mm-hmm. which doesn't obviously make sense. And so for me, when I started to get my life back on track, because I had, you know, was dealing with a health issue a handful of years ago, my success plan started simply with eat real food, make decisions, and be accountable, which we've talked about. And for me, that was what optimized my overall well-being, you know, gave me the energy that I was looking for. And really to find that healthy lifestyle that works for me, which is really in my life what I was looking for and what I help people to do. That said, there were also times even within that I realized I didn't exactly have a laid out plan. And so that's where I came up with the three P's. What's that first part that I needed? I needed to know, well, what was the plan? You know, what was my goal? And the goal is part of the plan. And obviously then there are these steps. And most of us are not very good at planning. You know, we have a calendar. I have three of them. You know, I have one upstairs that my husband and I share. I have my Google calendar. I have one on my, you know, my desk just to quickly flip through. So we're not really great at planning. And then what happens is when we face an obstacle or things don't quite work in that pseudo plan, we give up. Mm-hmm. So I know it's always said, you know, a goal without a plan is just a dream. So this is really where we want to sit down and access our inner guru, mm-hmm. and come to and sit down with a plan. What is it that we want? How do we want to achieve it? What resonates? So I ask you, Jean, if you have, what is the next thing you want to succeed in?
That question right there is so important, and it's so hard for people to answer, right? And going back to what I'll answer your question. I'm not avoiding much, but going back to what you had said before, if people are going out and getting all this information from all these different sources, and there's just information overload and it's overwhelming, it's easy to go, I have no idea. This seems like such a great idea in the beginning, but I don't remember because I've already listened to four other things. And that goal setting piece becomes really difficult. And I think you have to bring it back to simple, easy to understand bits and pieces, like what you just said. I needed to get to a healthy lifestyle. So let's start on a small thing and work towards it. Mm-hmm. And for me, setting goals is hard, but satisfying once you do it, because yes. Now all of a sudden you have a focus, mm-hmm. and it's okay to have goals in different areas of your life. So I have podcast goals. I have personal goals. I have professional goals, and I have relationship goals. But having them siloed, even though it's all me, having them siloed helps a little bit, and they eat, but they also each touch each other.
Yes. And so two things that I think are really important, especially when it comes to that, to creating those goals. Mm-hmm. I love the smarter goal. I love making smart goals because they're you can write them down and they're right in front of you, that you can keep them right in front of you. That's one of the first things I tell people. Let's look at what that first goal is. Like for me, I want to lose 5 pounds. What is that? That's my goal, because it's measurable. You know, it's pretty simple. You know, mm-hmm. I want to lose 5 pounds by August 9th, whatever. Mm-hmm. So smarter goals really helps you to start that plan. To me, that's really the beginning of the plan. Mm-hmm. When you talk about, you know, siloing things, something that I really love to do with my clients is the life wheel. Mm-hmm. And you've seen it, mm-hmm. called all sorts of different things. It's where that pie chart of where it says, you know, you have different aspects of your life, you know, your health, your sleep, your relationships. I love using one of those. And I actually recommend to my clients that they do it every quarter. Because this is how you can keep, you know, the silos, everything in a different section, but at the same time, because they all connect. I mean, your professional goals and your personal goals connect. Your personal goals and your relationship goals connect. Mm-hmm. And so by keeping an eye on that, the life wheel, and I change, depending on the client, we change the categories. Mm-hmm. And so that's a great way to, one, plan, but it's also a great way to prioritize.
Oh, I like that too. And people can understand that it ebbs and flows. It's really a moving thing. So it can change quarter to quarter. And what's interesting in what you're saying is when I talk to people for financial goals, you know, goals for me, when I'm talking to them about goals, I tell them the goals need to have three things. They have to have identifier. It has to have a name. It has to have a dollar amount assigned to it. And it has to have a time frame. So when you're saying, I want to lose 5 pounds in however long, you've just done the same thing with a non-financial goal, is you've given it a name, a purpose. You've said what your time frame is, and you said what you wanted to achieve during that time frame. So it makes it very simple. It's not just something that's out in the ether. It is this thing that's going to do this thing by this time frame.
Exactly. And too often when people start to create a plan, it's the, I want to lose 5 pounds. And then that's where it stays. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, kind of using the concept of the SMART goal gives you those other pieces that you need.
And then that gives you a chance to prepare. So now here's your goal. Now, what are you going to do to achieve that in the prepare part?
Right. Often in the prioritizing piece, before we get to the preparation, it really is, okay, so I want to lose 5 pounds by August 9th. In that priority. So maybe you actually want to lose 10 pounds, but sitting in that, you know, 10 pound, 5 pound, whatever it might be. So say I'm going to change my goal to, I want to lose 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. That for that prioritizes before you get to 10 pounds, you've got to get to that first five, right? So I think that's a little bit where we need to prioritize. You know, we can't have this grandiose, I need to lose 100 pounds by next month.
Mm-hmm. Break it into smaller sections that are mentally and physically attainable.
Right. So there's a little bit more of that prioritizing piece, but yes, now how do you prepare for that? Mm-hmm. You have to make sure that, one of the most important things is to get your family and friends on board. If you live with other people, you're trying to lose weight and you're going to say, I'm going to go vegan for a month. That's a little extreme, but let's just say that. And you do all the cooking. You might want to tell your spouse or partner that you're planning on doing this because it's going to affect them. Mm-hmm. So part of that preparation really is about preparing other people too. Mm-hmm. And it works with your work career goals too. If you have a goal that you want to reach in your job with your career and you work with other people, it's really important for them to know, because if you're busy doing something and you're not as available to people, they might get frustrated because you're not available to them the way you used to be. So again, preparation is really important to think of outside of you. Mm-hmm. And then of course, the most important thing is to then actually prepare yourself personally. Get the food that you want, get the recipes, plan meal planning times. So all of that comes into the preparation. And again, like I said, it works with your personal and professional and physical goals too.
One of the challenges of preparation, though, is that it can be a procrastinator because, well, I don't have everything in place, so this isn't going to work. So now we're in overcoming that perfection of preparation.
I was going to say, now we come into a fourth P, perfectionism.
Yeah. We're on the same page, right?
Exactly.
Well, I can't do this because I don't have it all. I don't have all the recipes. I don't have all the food. And that just creates a downward spiral.
It can. And so what I always tell my clients, especially when it comes to diet and exercise, is get one day right. Get one meal right. Mm-hmm. Let's start small. Mm-hmm. Because what will happen, especially with that perfectionism, if you don't have everything in place, everything's not perfect, then you go, oh, well, I screwed up. So I'm not going to reach this goal. Mm-hmm. You've got lots of time to reach a goal. You know, between now and August 9th, if I screw up today with you know, my goal of losing 5 pounds, I can definitely pick up tomorrow where I left off.
It's about giving yourself grace.
Part also.
Yeah. Giving yourself grace, mm-hmm. but not using it as a crutch to not try again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anytime we don't succeed in something, we automatically think that we're not good enough. We can't do this. And it really is a mindset. It's that internal judge that we have. You know, I always think it's the little angel on the one side and the little devil on the other. The little devil is a lot louder than the little angel. And so let's another time we'll talk about the little angel and the devil in more detail, and how that can help us, obviously, with success, with our health and our wellness, and our exercise goals and food goals.
I look forward to that. Thank you, Denise.
You're welcome.
As always, it's informative, but also achievable.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. This is Jean Gallagher, Discover Rising Tides, and I want to just take a moment to talk about my friend, Denise Segal. I am honored to call her as a friend, and I'm so grateful that she gives us her insight during our shows, each show, and talks about healthy living, eating real food. You hear Denise say, eat real food a lot. Well, she means it, and she knows what she's talking about. She is an amazing healthy living coach, curator at Living Healthy List. And if you ever have any questions about what is real food? Why does it matter? How does that apply to me? How do I change? What do I need to do? How do I even create a healthy living shopping list? Make sure that you call her. She is your healthy living coach. And you can find her at healthylivinglist.com. Hello and welcome back. My name is Jean Gallagher, Discover Rising Tides, and we're here with Dr. Laura Katina, and we're talking about veterinary care. And just as a recap from our first show together, we were talking about, I'm going to let you do a little bit more of the story, but we're talking about Laura and her business with her glove and how it happened. And so give us the quick rundown, and then we're going to dive into what's it like to be a veterinarian?
Sure. Thank you. So the quick rundown, graduated from vet school. And then about 6 months later, I had a terrible injury by a cat that resulted in extensive surgery, physical therapy on my hand for months. And because of that injury, I had the idea to develop the Armor hand gloves in order to protect, you know, animal caregivers from injury on the job. And that's kind of how the whole glove came about, because of that injury, and have been selling the gloves ever since then. Yeah.
So if you'd like to learn more about the gloves, go check out the other show. These are great for home, for you and your pet, and as well as in veterinary situations, rescues, wildlife rescue. I just think that the wildlife rescue, I could spend an hour just talking about that part, but let's go check out the other show, and we'll make sure when we're done here, we'll make sure you have links to everything too. But let's talk about, what is it like to go through vet school? And, you know, it is very common to say as a younger person, oh, I love animals, I want to be a vet.
I agree. Yes. No, I couldn't agree more with you. It's vet school. It's challenging. I mean, it's hard to get into. I did not get in on my first time, you know, and I was devastated, but you know, you reapply. I got in, and that is very common. And I'm glad it worked out that way looking back, because I made wonderful friends there. I wouldn't have had it any other way. But it's a hard program. You know, you have to have a lot of animal experience, small animal experience, large animal experience. They want a, you know, a very well-rounded candidate. And there's so few vet schools. And that's what's hard. It's, you know, not every state has a vet school. And so the seating is limited. And just it's a competitive program, you know. And, you know, I know I hear that a lot, because when I tell people I'm a veterinarian, they say, oh, when I was younger, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a vet. And I mean, I was surprised how hard the program was, how hard it was to get into. And also the life of a veterinarian and the work, it really opened my eyes. Yeah, I was not prepared for that.
Do they cover that in school?
They don't. And maybe things are different now, but I graduated from Ohio State back in 2008. And I'll be honest, there wasn't these discussions. I mean, it really the life of a veterinarian, it was not discussed. You know, the curriculum was really focused on vet med, and you know, we did the small animal and large animal rotations, and it was a wonderful program. But as far as the emotional and mental load of being a veterinarian, it was not a topic back then at all. Yeah.
And so once you've progressed through vet school and finding a job, and so there has to be two different pressures. One is starting a brand new job, but also the financial pressure of the last 4 years of school.
Absolutely. Yep. And I think those are huge stressors for anyone who is, you know, a new grad veterinarian starting mm-hmm. their career. It's, you know, we did an undergrad program for 4 years as a student, and then you continue 4 more years as a student. And so there's a huge financial, you know, pressure there. You want to get, mm-hmm. you want to work, you want to work a lot, you want to make money, pay off loans, you know, all of these factors. And I think it's hard, you know, vet school, it's 4 years, but you have to learn so many different aspects of medicine. So the regular vet practitioner, unless they're specialized, they have to have a very good understanding of, you know, dermatology and urology. You know, we work with the eyes, the ears, skin, coat, intestinal, GI tract, musculoskeletal system. So there's all of these components of an animal that we have to know how to treat. And unless the case is, you know, very advanced or we're not comfortable, we can always refer. But a veterinarian is expected, and, you know, we graduate with this knowledge base of treating the whole animal. And so it's a lot. And when you're, you know, when you graduate, there's a lot of cases that you haven't seen or even learned about mm-hmm. in vet school. And it's really just learning kind of as you go. And it's tough. Yeah, it was definitely tough that first year. Yeah.
And not only just the whole animal, you're also, you need to have surgical experience too.
Yes. And surgery on top of that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. So if you are a people doctor, mm-hmm. you would specialize in a thing. The thing right. is still complicated. People yes. are complicated, but you're not expected. You could be a GP and have a fairly rounded idea about the whole body, but you're sure. not expected I was going to say spay, but you know, yeah, yeah. it doesn't happen with people, right? Surgery, but you're not, yeah, but surgery in general.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
yeah, you're not expected to have to perform a surgery on a person right. as a general practitioner, but as a Absolutely. Veterinarian, you're coming out and right. to do that. And so what the financial advisor part of me wants to say, and I'm going to say it anyways, yes. what is the average cost of the 4 years of veterinary school?
So at Ohio State, what I ended up doing, I moved to Ohio during my application process. So when I was still getting, I wanted to get as much experience as I could. So I became a resident of Ohio. So my tuition was considerably less. I know that if I had gone to Penn, even as a resident, because it's, you know, private, I think it was 3 times the amount of Ohio State. Mm. So that was one major, and I love Ohio State and I love the curriculum there, but the cost was absolutely something mm-hmm. I had to consider. You know, I don't remember off the top of my head what it was per year, but I remember it was considerably less than going to Penn as mm-hmm. as a resident. So I obtained, you know, my residential status in Ohio and then applied again. I was still getting that experience. And one thing I thought of when you were talking about, you know, the human practitioner, you know, we're at the disadvantage where, you know, our patients, they're not telling us, you know, where it hurts. And this mm-hmm. has been I've had ear pain for the last week or so. So that's another aspect that I feel like it's a lot, you know, and you just mm-hmm. have to kind of, work through that. Yeah.
And so now you're out of school and yeah. you have a job and you are learning on the job as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All the time. I mean, medicines change all the time. Mm-hmm. Newer, improved medications, the way to treat patients is always, you know, it's always changing. So we're always required to do continuing education, and that helps. But still, I mean, every day, you know, I'll be looking things up, talking to colleagues, asking their opinion. That's a really strong aspect of veterinary medicine, where there, I feel like there's always a community that you can always ask somebody, get second, third opinions, whatever. And so that's very helpful. But I feel like always learning. Yeah, always learning.
So behind the scenes, you know, when I go to the vet, and I love my vet, Dr. Wendy's amazing. And we see the front side of it as a patient or a patient parent.
Sure.
Is, you know, the vet's friendly, the vet's compassionate, they're understanding, they're caring, they listen, they ask questions, they're gentle with the animals, and they truly love their job. But what is it like on the other side? What are the pressures of being a veterinarian?
Sure. I feel like there's so many pressures. I think the financial pressure is a huge component. I think that, and we touched a little bit on this before, but I think anybody who becomes a veterinarian, they don't do it to become rich. You know, we don't get paid like doctors. And, you know, I've noticed over the past few years, you know, if a client has a negative experience at a vet, there can be a lot of social media bullying, and that can just snowball and take off. And so I do think that people, you know, pet parents should be aware that being a veterinarian, it's a very hard job. You know, it's very rare that we have a day or an hour where we're playing with puppies and kittens. You know, it's just, we usually have euthanasias. We have cases that are end stage. You know, there's absolutely nothing we can do. And that's hard, you know, and it hurts. They're usually long hours. Often when you leave work, you can't really kind of let that work day go. And you're thinking in your head, could I have done better for this patient? Or did I calculate this right? And, you know, it's, you want to do the best. And we're very empathetic. We're very compassionate. And I think as a profession, we're givers. And so I think that we give, and we really have a hard time saying no. I can't pick up that shift. Or if somebody you haven't talked to in 2 decades is texting you about, you know, what's going on with their pet at midnight, it's okay to say, like, I don't have the mental capacity to deal with this right now. I need time. I'll get back to you tomorrow. Or just to set up some boundaries for ourselves. I think it's very hard for us to do as a profession. And even at work, you know, we may have a euthanasia, maybe we've been treating a patient for 10 years, and we have a euthanasia, and then we have to go into the next appointment and give them, you know, 100% and have the smile on our face and, you know, kind of deal with that grief and sadness of that previous appointment later. And I think it all just kind of builds up and up and up. And then sometimes we're just really putting our own wellness on the back burner. And that's hard. Yeah.
And that's really evident in the industry too, as far as what are the statistics? Or tell us more about that, because you're finding that veterinarians are committing suicide.
Yes. All the time, unfortunately, veterinarians are taking their lives. And I know that compassion fatigue, you know, is this term, and we hear it all the time in vet medicine, and it's very real. It's veterinarians are burnt out, you know, they're burnt out. They have these factors, all these stressors. And I just think it's very unbalanced. And there has been this epidemic of suicide in the veterinary profession, where, I mean, it could be new grads or people that have been practicing for 30, 40 years, and they're taking their lives. And it happens so often. And I almost actually feel like it's getting a little bit worse, unfortunately. I think that, you know, I don't have the answers, but I think that the very basic thing to start with is just really meeting our basic needs. You know, we need time away from work. We need mental health days. We need enough vets in the office. You know, I think that we're so understaffed, and that's hard as well. I think pet parents being understanding that we truly are doing our best, but there's a lot of things behind the scenes that they're not aware of. And just to show, you know, the vets and vet staff compassion and understanding, if we're running late, it's probably because we had a really difficult case, you know, before. And I know that at times, a hard thing is just the financial aspect in practice. Sometimes clients do not have the money to pay for services. And the dialogue becomes, well, if you cared about pets, you know, you would do this, or you, and it's, we have to, I think we all need to understand that is our profession. You know, we're working in a business. A lot of times these financial, it's out of our control. And so I just think there should be a better understanding about, you know, really how it is on the other side of things. And yeah, it's just been, it's been hard. I don't think that pet parents really see that other side of things.
What support systems are available for, you said that veterinarians are quite often a community. Are there support systems in place, or should there be more support systems in place?
I feel like there absolutely could be more. There's one organization, Not One More Vet, and they are based on really trying to save every life that they can. I think they're a wonderful organization, but I feel like we can always use more support. You know, I think just more conversations, more understanding from the client perspective, just, you know, even us taking accountability and saying, you know, no, I can't pick up that extra shift, or no, I need to use my day off. So I think it's so many facets of it where we also have to be accountable too, you know, and that's hard, but to use resources like therapy, you know, to keep up the best we can with our own wellness, you know, making time for our needs, setting boundaries wherever we can, you know, learning to say no. I think these are all things that can help us. Yeah.
Boundaries are important.
Yes.
And boundaries are difficult.
Yes.
And I wonder, many times we probably don't realize that we're not setting them.
I agree. Right. I think especially if we're, sometimes I almost feel like it becomes part of our personality. We're not even aware, like, oh, I could handle this differently, or I could say no, or I could say that doesn't work for me. And we're just so used to these habits. And I agree. I think there could be a lot more awareness, like, okay, what can I say no to? Where can I take time for myself? And I think we almost have to start there. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you recognize certain triggers for yourself that say, oh, I might not be doing this well? And if you're comfortable talking about this, you know, what are those triggers, or what do you notice within yourself and your body, or mentally, or do you recognize compassion fatigue?
Absolutely. So, and it's been really a learning process for me. I'm still learning every day about me and how I function and interact and everything. I do feel like I try to be very, patient and hold space for my kids. I notice though, when I'm impatient, it's almost like that's a reminder to me that, okay, something's off. So I need to do something for myself in order for me to be the best person, you know, to others. And so I will notice triggers. I think at work, if I have a day where, you know, it's back to back and I'm not staying hydrated, I'm not eating, it's very difficult cases, or maybe like a difficult client here and there, I'll notice sometimes if I don't really process that and take time for me at some point that day, and it just swings over to the next day and on and on and on, I just feel like that stress is compounded. And I really had to really, even if it's sitting in the car for 10, 15 minutes after work, and process like, okay, I did my best and this is what I can do tomorrow, and kind of just really mentally just separate and break up and process that day for me, that absolutely helps. I try to eat well, you know, try to be outside, exercise, anything that I can do just to help my mental, emotional health, I'm trying to do, because I know how it feels to be on the other side of that. And for, I'd say for years, as a new grad, I was very burnt out. I was grabbing the fast food, wasn't exercising, wasn't keeping up with medical appointments, felt like I didn't have time for therapy. If I had a difficult interaction with a friend or a relative, I didn't process that, or I wasn't mindful. I didn't have this awareness. And so I felt like that wasn't the way I wanted to live. You know, I really saw the other side of that. And so it is work, and I have to hold myself accountable, but I don't want to go back to that version, you know, that person. And so it's important for me to just, do my best and try to keep up with it. Yeah.
That thought process and really learning about yourself and recognizing those signals is not just for the veterinary world. It really is applicable to everywhere. And especially if you're a mom and you have young kids and you have a career and you have these other responsibilities, and being able to say, I can't, no.
Right. Absolutely. But,
and being comfortable with that, it doesn't mean you're not going to do anything. It means that you need to take care of yourself so that you can be present for others.
Absolutely. Right. It doesn't make you a bad person, a bad coworker, a bad mom. Like you have to take care of yourself. And that has been such a lesson for me. You know, I have to, or else I cannot take care of the people I love. And, and so, I mean, I frequently do have to still remind myself of that. You've got to take care of yourself. Yeah, for sure.
So what are the wonderful things about being a vet? Let's change the mood here a little bit.
So, I love the clients. It is very rare that you have a client that just, it's hard to communicate with. And I do understand from their perspective that they, of course, also want the best for their pet. You know, I think it's just, you know, it's just two different situations. And so sometimes it's hard to see the other person's viewpoint. But I think we all, of course, want the best for the pets and want to do as much as we can. So I think, you know, the clients I've met have been amazing. Of course, the patients, you know, I love it because every single one is unique, has their own personality. So, I mean, I love that aspect. My coworkers are phenomenal. I really feel like veterinarians, I mean, we do great work, but we could not do the work we do without the vet staff. And so they are just, they're really key to the practice. You know, I just think too, just the learning and evolving as a veterinarian helps me with my own dogs. And so it's just, you know, there's many positives about it. The medical aspect, I mean, I just have always liked medicine and the way, you know, the body systems work and stuff. So I get to, you know, work with that. And so it's a rewarding profession. I just think we need to, you know, we just have to be a little bit more mindful and balance it a little bit better. Yeah, for sure.
And say thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, when you're taking your dog or your cat or your iguana, whatever it is, to the vet, be appreciative and say thank you. And that goes a long ways.
It does go a long way, because I think we're all trying our best, you know, everybody. And so I think just to be appreciative and it does go a long way just to say thank you and just to know that, we want to do the best for your pet and we're giving it our all. So,
So in the last few minutes, let's talk about home care and the Armor Hand Glove.
Sure.
And so how, we touched on that before, but I just want to spend a couple of minutes because I think it's something that I didn't even realize and how amazing this is for a just regular mom and dad of cats and dogs and whatever we have. You had spoken about people that are pregnant or immune compromised and how is this glove effective and why is it so important?
Sure. So, anyone who has a weakened or immunocompromised immune system, bites and even scratches can be lethal. And so pregnant women, you know, unfortunately, so many people are going through chemotherapy, so their immune systems are compromised. Elderly people, you know, anybody that is in those categories and has to pill, medicate, you know, their pet at home. A lot of pets are getting insulin injections. So owners have to, you know, they're handling the syringe and giving the injections at home. So anyone in those categories, I absolutely think should be protected. Any type of bat, bite or scratch can really compromise the health even further. In my case, when I was injured, I was young, completely healthy, had nothing on my health record at all. And it changed the direction of my health. So I am considered immunocompromised because the infection was so severe and I wasn't responding to the antibiotics. And so you know, people who have already immunocompromised systems absolutely need to protect themselves. If I had been immunocompromised when I got this injury, I do not think I would be alive today. So I do feel like even healthy people, they need to assess, you know, if the cat really doesn't like being pilled or getting that injection, it only takes a second to put on the gloves and just protect yourself in case there's a reaction. You know, we want the pet to be comfortable, but also to get the medication and also have the caregiver protected. So it's just a simple thing that, that animal, you know, that pet parents can do, in order to give their pet the care they need, but also to protect themselves.
It's fantastic. That's amazing.
Thank you.
So how can people find you, find your glove?
Sure. So on the website, it's armorhandglove.com. We also have a Facebook page and an Instagram as well. And you can find the gloves on the website. If you have any questions about the gloves, there is a customer form that you can fill out. And if we don't have the size you need, you can fill out the notify me form and we'll definitely reach out to you and we have more in stock. But the website has a lot of good information on there and resources. So I hope people check it out.
And when you go to the website, my favorite part of your website is the In the Wild page.
I love that page.
People have to go check out the In the Wild page on the website because it's amazing. The pictures of the rescued, especially the rescued birds, just incredible. Right.
They do wonderful rescues. It's California Wildlife Encounters and Ben Knuckles. It's all volunteer work and he does amazing. He works 365 days a year doing these rescues and they provided amazing video pictures, testimonials, everything. And I think the cases are really, really interesting to read what they do. Yeah.
Great. Laurie, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Today's show is sponsored by Seaside Solutions, my financial services company. As a business owner, it's easy to be pulled in many different directions and often taking care of yourself plummets to the bottom of the list. For me, I find myself outside to reground. My time outdoors helps me manage my day more effectively and be more present for my clients. Through this, Discover Rising Tides was born. At Seaside Solutions, we truly believe that education is the foundation of financial wellness. Our primary focus is to provide guidance that is designed to help you achieve your long-term financial goals and visions. Working with a plan allows space for doing more things that you love, like being outside to make the inside better. If I can help you create or realign your plan, or if you would like to be added to my weekly newsletter, please let me know. This week's topic was 5 ways to set more achievable goals. Your referral means the big, beautiful world to me. And if I can help, please let me know. And thank you so much for listening and see you next time.